Hello, everybody. I'm Danny Boom Boom McCarthy.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Story of Nowhere podcast. As always, I'm your host, Daniel McCarthy. In today's episode, we've got a very special guest, Stefan Verstappen, an expert in disaster preparedness. We live in a world of uncertainty, never quite knowing when our institutions will finally fail us. In fact, there are many people who would tell you that our institutions already have failed us. Thus, it is incumbent on all of us who are concerned with surviving and thriving to be prepared to navigate a hostile environment and rise to the challenge of any catastrophe that may face us, be it subtle or sudden. In short, we must all be prepared to navigate dystopia. And that right there ought to tell you why I invited Mr. Verstappen onto the show. The past year has revealed to pretty much every American that certain luxuries and comforts of life that we take for granted ought not to be taken for granted. They can be taken away. Now, unfortunately, a great many people in the population have responded to this realization not by adopting constructive and sustainable habits, but instead by succumbing to fear. By succumbing to fear and placing their blind faith in broken institutions that ought not to be trusted. But then there are those of us for whom 2020 was indeed a wake-up call, a stark reminder that complex social structures are not immune to entropy. Quite the opposite, in fact. So in this interview, my guest and I discuss just how we might actually survive in the shadow of this collapsing edifice. But more importantly, we discuss how to thrive, namely by creating small, independent communities that can actually provide for the needs of its members. And this is no utopian pipe dream. This is, in fact, the default for our human species. And I submit that it's the true remedy for the actual utopian delusion that animates the global political structures, which tremble and quake precariously around us. Now, during this interview, we had a live audience of two, and while you won't actually hear from them, they do each offer Stefan a question towards the end of the interview. Be sure to check out Stefan Verstappen's work, both at YouTube, under the channel Stefan Verstappen, and at his website, China Strategies. Without further ado, let's get right into the interview. Thank you all again for listening to the Story of Nowhere podcast. Enjoy. Can we start by talking about a little bit about your background? Like, what is it that got you into survivalism, if that's what you want to call it, or disaster preparedness? How did you get into this in the first place?
Well, I'm 64, so I grew up in an age where we were constantly bombarded with the threat of Armageddon. As a kid, I remember our parents, when they bought their first house back in 1963, you had the option, when you bought the house, to have a fallout shelter in the backyard. We were under the sword of Damocles, constant threat of nuclear annihilation. And this was, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, it was the Cold War, and everybody was worried about nuclear war with Russia. And so from an early age, you know, you're bombarded with this end of the world meme in media, movies, TV. So I began getting ready for the end of the world when I was about 12 years old. And I started with learning outdoor survival. I joined the Outward Bound Club for 3 years. And I just continued from there. I learned how to survive in the woods, learn how to fire a rifle and a pistol and a bow and arrow. And then I went into, I became an instructor for St. John Ambulance, which is the British Commonwealth equivalent of Red Cross. So England, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and Hong Kong have a St. John Ambulance, and it's a volunteer ambulance service. And I taught for them because at the time I had also started studying martial arts. And I really liked the ancient Chinese tradition that martial arts masters were also healers. And when I went to Hong Kong to study martial arts, my teacher, Master Chan Hong Chung, was a doctor. And then when I went to Taipei, Taiwan, to study martial arts, My teacher there, Master Tsai Renzhu, was also a doctor. So I like that idea that, you know, if you are going to learn how to break bones, you should also learn how to mend those broken bones. I think that's just fair. You know, it's the yin and the yang. And then the threat changed from nuclear annihilation, which is still sort of a threat now, but not as much as it used to be, to other types of threats, you know, global warming, global cooling, hole in the ozone, zombie apocalypse. And throughout it all, I studied and I trained. So now I've got, you know, 50 years of experience in survivalism. So that's how I got into it.
Awesome. Well, I think that now so many people have been sort of just living their comfortable lives for however many years. You know, you watch TV after work, you do your job, keep your head down, and everything just kind of stays relatively normal. And then 2020 happened. And I think that last year, for a lot of regular Americans, I'll just speak for my own countrymen, for a lot of Americans, the last year was a kind of wake-up call that, oh, wow, you know, things actually can get bad. And certainly the events of 2020 were not as bad as things have gotten historically. Like, certainly the COVID pandemic is nothing compared to the Black Death of the 1350s. And certainly the crackdowns, like, as far people are talking about martial law in America, it's like, I get where they're coming from, but it's also nothing like actual martial law crackdowns in like Nazi Germany or the Soviet Union or something like that. So we are certainly still living relatively free. And yet I think that the past year has given people just a glimpse of the negative turn that events could take, perhaps worse in the future. So I appreciate that the mentality of people has kind of come around to the idea that things could get worse, things could degrade. We could have to deal with like a really bad health situation, a pandemic, or we could also have to deal with a really authoritarian state. Now, unfortunately, I think that because people haven't spent their lives, as you have done, not just preparing materially, but also preparing emotionally and mentally and spiritually for such a downturn, that awareness of the potential negative threats had manifested not in competence, but in fear of the vast majority of people. So how would you approach a fearful populace in the event of a crisis and essentially calm things down? What would you do to mitigate that sort of panicky fear and actually begin to organize things and get everything back on track?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer, Daniel. Because we are suffering now. First of all, I wrote an article for the Trends Journal, Gerald Celente's publication, and it was called Historical Cycles, Are We Doomed to Repeat the Past? And the article is based on my research of history. My first book is on, you know, Chinese military history, and I'm a big fan of history. I read a lot of history. Don't get me started on ancient Egyptian chronology. A lot of arguments to make against the current accepted chronology. Anyways, I get into history. I love history. I read it a lot. And part of my interest is a book I read when I was like 15 years old by Isaac Asimov called The Foundation Series. And it's probably the first major science fiction book ever written. You know, Dune and Star Trek and all those other movies all based much of their plot lines on the original Foundation trilogy or series. It started off as a trilogy and then he came out with a few more. Now, the basic premise of those books was this, that in the distant future, a giant galactic empire, a certain historian was able to see repeating patterns in history. He called it psychohistory. And he was able to predict the coming collapse of this civilization. And what he did was he sent out a colony to a distant planet called Foundation. And there he hoped to kind of keep the remnants of humanity safe and alive until after the giant collapse of the empire. So I always had that in my mind, and I've studied historical cycles ever since. And when I read history, I'm always looking for the pattern. What does this reveal? How will this apply to the future? And so my essay that I wrote for Gerald Celente, and it's also now a video. You can listen to the video, watch the video. It's called Are We Doomed to Repeat the Past? Or Historical Cycles. It's on my YouTube channel. So what I've done is I've taken all the theories of historical cycles, and there's many, you know, it goes all the way back to Polybius and Herodotus, and all the great historians throughout history have all seen this pattern, and they all wrote about it. They said, look, this is what happens, you know, history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. It continually follows a similar pattern, and especially in terms of empire. And the cycle of an empire, the life cycle of an empire, is about 250 years. It rises, it matures, it blossoms, there's a golden age, and then everything turns to shit. And you end up in a period of what's called chaos. And during chaos, everything's gone. And the chaos may last, you know, 50 years, 100 years, 200 years. And eventually somebody will come along again, a great leader, usually a warrior, and he will found a new dynasty. He'll found a new a civilization, and the pattern starts over again, another 250 years. So my understanding of historical cycles points conclusively to the fact that we are at the end of our cycle now. The United States has been a constitutional republic for about 250 years. It's over. And we are going into a period, what is known as chaos, which is complete social breakdown. No law and order. All the major institutes will be either too corrupt or too defunct to provide any services. So no medical, no power, no internet, no fuel. I mean, it all goes. And then there's usually a dramatic decrease in population during the period of chaos. Millions of people die. So this is the prediction that I have for the future. We're going into the end times for our civilization. And I think that's pretty obvious right now that that's what's happening. So in order to survive that, in order to alleviate people's fear, while people live in fear all the time, one of the conditions during the age of chaos, which I'm about to release a video on, and one of the other signs that I failed to include in my original article is that during the period of chaos, people will suffer from what is called mass psychosis. And this means a psychosis means an inability to perceive reality. And when you cannot perceive reality, you are technically and for all means and purposes insane. And this happens to the vast majority of a population during the period of chaos. People will all go completely insane. Now look around you. We all say that, oh my God, things have gotten crazy. It's clown world. It's upside down world. Well, yes, but those aren't just metaphors for a dysfunctional society. Those are accurate descriptors for a whole population that has lost their minds. And this is why it's so difficult to approach people and try to, you know, wake them up and get them on board. And well, you can't wake them up because they're insane. It's like going to somebody that says, well, you know, I'm Napoleon. Yeah, but you're not Napoleon. Well, you're wrong because I know I'm Napoleon and you're a bad person for disagreeing with me. I mean, you can't argue with them. You can't argue with schizophrenics. You can't reason with them. You can't use logic with them. So the vast majority of our population right now are insane. You can try and wake a few up. There might be a few still sitting on the fence. I don't think there's that many. You know, you said that, people are starting to wake up more now. Well, maybe. I don't see it, to be honest with you. Yeah, maybe another couple hundred wake up, but that doesn't matter when 80% of the population is lining up for the COVID shot. What are you going to do? You know, that's 80% of the population that are completely insane. And but in order for mass psychosis to take place. And this is what Carl Jung wrote about. Carl Jung wrote about mass psychosis, and he called it epidemic psyche. And basically, it's the same thing. He also said that, you know, large groups of people, huge swaths of the population will go insane. And he says, but you need two prerequisites in order for a population to go insane. One of them is they have to be uneducated. They have to be ignorant. They have to be stupid. And, well, we've had over 100 years of deliberate dumbing down of the educational system so that, you know, even I, with my high IQ and all my experience, I cannot pass an 1868 grade 7 exam. I can't do it.
Right.
Most university professors couldn't do it. That's how dumbed down we are, that, you know, the brightest minds of our time cannot compete with a 13-year-old in 1868. And never mind what the Jesuits were taught, and even before that. So, you know, the dumbing down is complete. It's well established. Never mind the dumbing down, but also the socialist indoctrination, which makes it even worse. I mean, it's bad enough to be stupid, but it's even worse to be a stupid socialist, which is what we have now coming out of the schools. So we've got that prerequisite down. Now, the second prerequisite is fear. Carl Jung said that fear is the most dangerous aspect of the mass psychosis, because people are afraid and then they lose their minds. And that's what we have now. But look at what's been going on for the last at least 100 years. The media, the movies, the government, it has been endless fear porn. Starting from when I was a kid, the Russians are going to nuke us, and you better have a fallout shelter in your backyard. And, you know, then it's going to be Red Dawn. They're going to parachute into North Koreans. And now it's going to be the Chinese. And then it's the COVID. And then it's the SARS flu. And then it's global warming. And then it's Earth rotation and the axis and the hole in the ozone layer and street crime. And, oh, my God. I mean, that's, you know, I know. If it bleeds, it leads is the motto of the press, meaning that, you know, bad news sells. People like to hear bad news. But all this bad news we've been getting over 100 years, this constant fear, has, you know, added to the susceptibility of the population to go insane. And now with the COVID, you know, there's 80% of the people are terrified of this virus. So they're insane. But even those of us that are not terrified of the virus, that are, you know, we see through the propaganda, we see through the ruse, the few of us that are still sane to some degree, we're fearful too. I'm fearful because I'm afraid of the realization that I live in a madhouse, that everybody I know and everybody I see on the streets is a lunatic, and you cannot trust lunatics. So that's pretty scary. Then the other thing that frightens me is the undeniable fact that the deep state or the new world order, whatever label you want to put on it, is hell-bent and determined to murder billions of us. It's obvious. That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to kill a lot of people. They've written about it in all their, you know, their papers and their quarterly reports and their addresses and their meetings. And, you know, they're all talking about how to kill a lot of people. Bill Gates has taken the lead. I know how to kill a lot of people here with this, you know, phony vaccine. So, yeah, that's kind of frightening. So I live in a madhouse where the people who are in charge of the madhouse are trying to kill me. So that's a lot of fear. But listen, one of the first and foremost things people have to do is overcome the fear. And that's why I wrote my most recent book, The Way of the Warrior. This is a time for warriors. And by a warrior, I mean a person that is self-reliant, has the ability to critically think, has some military tactics knowledge, some self-defense skills, you know, even if it's just a self-defense course, and take a firearms course and take a wilderness survival course, you know, that you are completely self-reliant. You can defend yourself. You are cunning and ruthless when need to be, and you are a critical thinker. You do not follow the crowd. As a rule, wherever the crowd goes, if you're smart, you'll go in the opposite direction. You do not become part of the herd. You do not become part of the mob. And most importantly for a warrior is you have to overcome your fear. And once you do that and you're not terrified of living in a lunatic asylum run by psychopathic child murderers, then you have a chance to fight back. But if you don't overcome your fear and if you don't become a warrior, you're not going to survive this.
Yeah, and you're probably in that education also going to need to get some philosophy. You know, you're going to need to not just know what to do, but why you're doing it. You're going to need some sort of, for lack of a better term, spiritual motivation behind your activities so you can actually have a standard by which you can judge the actions of yourself and others. Because so many people, I think, just kind of living in the world without much of a thought out philosophy are more susceptible to just being part of that herd because they're not judging things on their own critical standard. Instead, they're just accepting whatever is told to them. They're accepting the offered truths that are being handed to them without critically analyzing them and weighing them against their own individually formed philosophy in order to come to individual, independent decisions on how to behave, how to react. And instead, they're just responding in this sort of programmed way. So I always recommend people to start, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean like going back and reading all the great books or anything like that. I mean, you could do that, but really a philosophical education just starts with going for a walk. Honestly, go outside and just start asking questions, start wondering about why things work the way they do. And if you just consistently prod reality in your own mind, and you use the brain that you have to create mental constructs and experiment with things and play out scenarios, then you're on the road to actually developing a personal philosophy, which is probably something that we should all be doing rather than accepting whatever sort of pseudo philosophies or ideologies are being presented by schools, media, churches, et cetera, et cetera. Now, so I want to talk a little bit about now. You described the sort of fallen age in which we live. And obviously this is a historical theme that pops up all over the place. I mean, we could go back to Hesiod in ancient Greece. So this is before people were actually writing linear histories. He was an epic poet. And he talked about, he was around the time of Homer, for people in the audience who might not know. Hesiod was a great poet around the time of Homer, who had a very sour view of life on earth. And he described us living in five ages. He said the first age was gold and everyone was great. Everything was great. And then silver, the silver age followed that. And it was pretty good. It wasn't great, but it was pretty good. And then that sort of degraded into the bronze age. And then there was like a brief uptick after the bronze age, where there was what he called the heroic age, where like this sort of rebellious young generation that came after the bronze people, they sort of tried to get back to silver, but it didn't quite work. And then everything collapsed into what he called the Iron Age, which was just a terrible, terrible, all the people were liars and corrupt and institutions were failing. And even the weather was bad. Like he just described this, but he says that it will eventually swing back up. We will make our rounds again. And of course the Prometheus myth, in the plays of Aeschylus, he talks about these same things. So this really is the idea of history moving in cycles is something that's been, at least in Western culture, but I know it's been in other cultures too, really since longer than people were actually doing the art of history. It's in our myth. Yeah. So this is probably something that we should all be acquainting ourselves with. So that being the case, assuming that a collapse at some point will come, whether or not it's coming tomorrow or in 10 years, who knows? We don't know, but let's just assume that we should know what to do in a collapse. One thing that my wife and I have been talking about for like a year now, really more than that, is basically this, I'll phrase it as a question for you. What can we learn from organizations like the CIA, the Freemasons, and the loosely organized Underground Railroad from the Civil War days in America, as to how to behave, how to act, how to procure information, how to move bodies, and how to move resources in a hostile environment. So assuming everything has fallen apart, what are we going to do to get our buddy where he needs to be, to get so-and-so food, and to make sure this crucial information, whatever it may be, is preserved and given to the right people without being detected? Basically, how do we start a secret society?
Yeah, well, that's a big question, Daniel. You got 10 hours? Listen, the first things first, everybody needs to be personally prepared. So you need, minimum 3 months worth of food in your house, water, a good medical kit. You need radios, ham radios, even CB radios, walkie-talkies, emergency radios, so that you have some form of communication. You need some form of security. If you can buy a firearm, definitely buy a firearm. And it doesn't matter. You don't need a machine gun. You can just get a 22 caliber bolt action single shot rifle. Something though, because nothing is nothing, but something is something. So you need security. You need shelter materials. You need your bug out bag. And you need to be personally prepared so that you can handle 3 months without electricity, 3 months without the stores open, 3 months without police and 911 working. That's the first thing. Now, in terms of organizing a secret society, well, that's exactly what we're going to have to do. You see, we are now under a communist tyranny. These lockdowns are not a result of a pandemic. These lockdowns are the result of a communist government. Because under a Republican government, these lockdowns could not take place. It's unconstitutional and absurd that every mayor and governor and president and vice president can suddenly issue executive orders. Executive orders are against the Constitution. If you have somebody that just says, well, I'm going to issue an order and write it on a piece of paper, now it's the law of the land, you're talking about a dictatorship. You know, none of these executive orders were brought up in front of Congress and voted on. Certainly the people of our country never had a chance to even put in some input or vote whether they want any of these executive orders to go through. But they're going through, and this lockdown is the true face of communism. And it's exactly what communism does. It seeks to control, micromanage every aspect of your life. Can you go out? Can you go to work? How many people can you talk to? Can you speak in public about things that they don't want you to speak about? Can you get together with five people for dinner? Can you go for a run in the park? I mean, they control every little detail of your life and restrict it. You have no rights left. You have no freedoms left. Now they're coming for the guns. And that's all because of executive orders issued by basically communists under the false flag pretext of a pandemic. But again, if we were a true democratic republic, they could not do this. So we're not a true democratic republic. We are under a communist tyranny right now. So people always ask, well, what can we do to fight back and wake people up? Well, I'll be honest with you. I'm pretty black-pilled on this. There's nothing we can do now. We have lost this war. Now, remember, the communists have been working on this for over 100 years. You know, the long march through the institutions, they've infiltrated every aspect of our government and our society, from the schools to the media to the newspapers and publishers and magazines and television. You know, they've infiltrated all of it and they've subverted it. So they're in control of everything. We've lost. How are you going to fight against everybody? That's what communism does. And then it divides all the people against each other. You can't trust your neighbors because they'll inform on you if you have five people over for dinner. We've seen that now on the YouTube. How many YouTube videos have we seen of people being dragged out of their houses because they had a couple of people over for dinner and their neighbors informed on them? And in England now, they're trying to have school children work as informants to tell on their parents. You know, do your parents have a gun at home? Do your parents deal drugs? You know, tell the teacher and then we'll deal with it. You know, so it's getting to the point where you can't even trust your own family. But that's what communism does. Look what happened, you know, in Russia and the Eastern Bloc countries during the Cold War. Nobody trusted anybody. You couldn't trust your coworker, your brother, your sister, your wife, your kids, nobody, because any one of them and all of them could be an informant. So we've lost. It took them 100 years to take over, and we slept through it all. Most of us slept through it all. You know, we did have the John Birch Society, and we did have what's his name there in the States that got so demonized for his routing out the communist infiltration of the country. But we've lost. So now we have to adopt the same tactics that the communists did, which means we have to form small communities of people we can trust. And it can't be a big community, more than 10 people. It's not going to work, because more than 10 people, one of those people will be an informant, and you don't know who it's going to be. But one of them will be either undercover police or an informant or a snitch. So it's got to be really tight-knit communities. This is what the communists did. They formed revolutionary cells, 5 people in a cell, only one person knew, one person in the next cell over. So even if that cell were to be captured, the police wouldn't be able to trace it back into the other cells and be able to arrest everybody. So your small autonomous cells that have they have a buffer go between one person that goes between one cell and the other that nobody knows about, so that he can't be captured and tortured into revealing the location of the other cells. And then everything you have to do has to be undercover and secretive. And, you know, you're going to have to learn how to, you know, use all the tactics from the CIA and spycraft. And, you know, I've been working on videos. It's called now, I got a series I'm still adding to it, called Urban Survival Tactics, in which I try to teach some of the tactics that you're going to need, such as the ability to assume authoritarian symbols, the ability to use disguises, counter-surveillance tactics, a cover story, the ability to bullshit your way out of a tight situation. These are the type of skills we're going to need now, because those of us that are still sane, you are now the counter-revolutionaries, and you will be hunted. And so if you, you know, maybe in your sleep, you're dreaming of freedom, somebody will be listening in and report you, and they'll come for you. Coming soon. Look, they're already arresting all those people that were at the January 6th demonstration at the Capitol. I mean, they're rounding them up and hunting them down right now and putting them in prison. Come on, this is what the communists do. So small communities, I'm working on a book called The Complete Guide to Forming Communities, and one large chapter of that book will be how to form a survivalist community, let's call it that, and how to work together to feed yourself and get medical attention and establish safe houses and establish an underground railroad, you know, just like they did during the abolitionist period, and look after each other. Because the thing is, as Hesiod mentioned, he had the 5 stages. I condensed Hesiod's 5 models into 4, or 5 stages into 4, because 4 is more common among the other theories as well. But as Hesiod stated, that after the age of chaos, there will be a new golden age. The thing is for us to survive until the golden age. And that's why we need to, you know, be strong, be a warrior, and form small underground communities. You can call them secret societies. That's fine, because that's how the secret societies infiltrated our society and destroyed it. Our society, our civilization is done. And much of that work was done by secret societies, as you said. And I just want to touch on quickly what you mentioned earlier about having a philosophy. You see, this war is a two-front war. On the one front, the exoteric is, you know, the censorship. They're going to, you know, shut down the food supplies. They're going to have police, you know, break up any protests and haul you out of the house. And you know, this is the one front of the war, the physical front, where they're going to, you know, they're going to come and take what they can from you and deprive you as much as possible, and hopefully you'll die. The second front of this war is a spiritual front, because if they defeat you spiritually, then they've defeated you physically. And part of the spiritual attack is what the Soviet defector, Bezmenov wrote it. Yeah. He called it the demoralization stage. And this is really a psychic spiritual attack. The demoralization stage is where their programming and their subversion of everything good and wholesome and decent in the world just makes people give up. They're demoralized. They don't have the will to fight back. And this is a spiritual war. So you do need a philosophical basis from which to fight this spiritual war. And that's what communism does. Communism destroys your soul. Go to any former communist country and you see the number of empty people walking around that were destroyed under communism, and they've never recovered. I've seen it myself. You know, the people that lived through the Stalinist purges and that, they're done. They're, you know, they don't have any will to survive anymore. So in terms of philosophy, I recommend Stoicism. It's a good one to, you know, to get you through these tough times. And personally, I sprinkle in a little bit of Zen, a little bit of Fourth Way, a little bit of Confucius. And for me, I have now a nice, tasty soup of philosophy. And that's my my strength to face this spiritual battle.
Well, I like that a great deal. I definitely, I wouldn't recommend that somebody just like pick any one school of thought and then say, I'm this now, like ascribing to it. I much prefer the approach that it sounds like you take, where you're actually cherry picking is a sort of negative term, but I like it. You're kind of cherry picking what makes sense and what fits from each, from all sorts of different philosophies, sort of like enjoying the cognitive buffet that exists out in the world, and then assembling your own personalized plate of philosophy rather than just saying, I'm an Aristotelian and that's it. And that's what I am. Like you could take what's useful from all these different schools of thought from all over the world and really come up with something beautiful and truly reflective of where you're coming from and where your position is in the world. So that is a very productive attitude to take within one's own life. And tying that into what you're talking about as far as creating these like mutual aid societies or secret societies, if we want to use that term too, it's about being constructive rather than destructive. Like what you were saying about setting up some sort of community, you're not like, oh, we need to subvert this and subvert that. It's like, well, maybe, but it seems to me what you're saying, the most important aspect of getting together with a group of people you trust is to actually recreate on a small scale, the sorts of institutions that have fallen apart, that have decayed in the larger society, that we can no longer rely on the larger society for medical care, provision of food, and blah, blah, blah. We need to be able to be the ones that can provide these necessities to one another. So really it's about rebuilding an actual society and actually having something that we can lean on. We can be productive with one another. We can communicate reliably and with people that we trust in order to essentially reestablish that which society was always supposed to be and no longer is. So it's sort of like the mutual aid community that pops up in the midst of a calamity is sort of the tip of the spear, breaching the veil in the chaos, opening everything back up to that golden age by reestablishing, again, on a small scale, those institutions that represent the virtues of society, by reintegrating those from a grassroots level. And then hopefully as time ticks on and the calamity sort of fades away and people begin to say, hey, we would like a reliable society, then what was once a mutual aid community can then begin to blossom out into other communities, and these institutions can then grow. So I hope people will take away from this that when, you know, you're talking about or I brought the term secret societies into it. And I think that we're both on the same page that it's not what people think of necessarily as, like, you know, we're going to flash each other secret hand signs and do some sketchy shit. Like, no, really the point is actually to be constructive, to actually take care of the people around us, because specifically because the institutions that we're told as children we're supposed to be able to rely on, well, we can't. So I guess we've got to do it ourselves. And this is simply how that is done. We need to build, we need, like you said, we need to have some medical skills. We need to be able to respond to emergencies. We need to be able to have enough food so that, you know, if shit hits the fan and you're on the run, you need to come to my place. Like, all right, I've got some beans for you. You know, this is how an actual community is going to survive. So again, I want people to really appreciate that this is about being constructive in the face of disaster. So the next question I would like to ask you is, while things are relatively calm, I know maybe now they're not as calm as they were, but like back in 2019 or something, when the world was relatively normal, you know, there was no pandemic yet. There weren't riots and news of people storming the Capitol and all this sort of stuff. Everything was fairly calm. What are the sorts of things that, or I'll frame it this way, what are the sorts of habits, sustainable habits, that we can all employ in our own lives relatively cheaply and efficiently in order to be better prepared for a calamity? And even if the calamity doesn't come, to just have a better and more sustainable home life.
First of all, I'd like to jump back and comment a couple of your comments.
Sure.
Yes, you are absolutely correct. You have to cherry pick your philosophy. The famous Zen master Takuan Soho wrote in his book, Zen Mind, Beginner Mind, that everybody must create their own path. You can't follow somebody else's path. You must create your own. And this is something I've always taught my students, like even in the martial arts. Yes, the classical style that I teach is Hong Quan and Siba Lo Han Quan. But you don't have to mirror that. You don't have to imitate that. Take the best and create your own style. So I've studied many different styles. So I take the best of Kung Fu. I take the best of Jiu-Jitsu. I take the best of Krav Maga. I take the best of Taekwondo and the best of Karate. And so what I do is the style of Stefan. It's my style. I've taken what suits me, what I like, what I'm good at, what I've managed to perfect. And that is my style. And you can't be Stefan's style. You have to create your own style. So that's true with martial arts and it's true with philosophy. Take the best and make your own path. Everyone walks this world alone and you have to make your own way. Now, about the institution. So examining the fate that we are about to encounter with the collapse of society, I went back and I studied history to see what did they do in the past during these times? And of course, creating communities is the number one solution. And even before, you know, right now, we're going to see the end of all this government largesse. You know, the food stamps are going to go, the free medical care is going to go, the schools are already destroyed, the medical system is non-functional. So what did they do before that? Well, communities organized and provided all these services for themselves. So before health insurance and before Medicare and Medicaid, people would contribute, they would form a community, you know, 1,000 members, they'd all pitch in one day's wages a year. And for that, they got all their medical needs met. They hired their own doctors. They opened their own clinics. I mean, it's not rocket science. You find a space, you open a clinic, you buy some of the medical equipment that you might need, and then you hire a doctor on an hourly basis to come in and maybe a couple of nurses. And now everybody's got free healthcare or free in terms of one day's pay, wages a year. That's what they did. And they were so successful and they raised so much money that not only did they start off with free healthcare, they ended up building hospitals and things like sick children's hospitals where they treated other people for free. They ended up building their own senior and retirement homes and intensive care units. And they even bought property and built amusement parks and picnic grounds for their members to go to. I mean, this is how much that you can do when you have just, you know, a couple thousand people kicking in $20 a month. The money is how much you raise is phenomenal, and what you can do with it when you're not paying all that money in taxes and bribes and kickbacks and everybody else, you know, trying to steal their little piece of the pie of it. That money goes a long way. And so that's what they did. Same thing with education. Before public education, people organized their own schools. The community, you know, built a little schoolhouse, and they hired the teachers themselves to teach the curriculum. And so today the modern equivalent would be homeschooling. But if you, I know a few people that do the homeschooling, but they do it as part of a community. So you get 10 families that decide they all want to homeschool their children. And instead of, you know, mom staying home all day long, having to do everything, those duties are spread out between 10 moms. And what they do is they get a room at the church basement, and everybody sends their kids there. And one day it's one mom teaching the class, and the next day it's another mom. So, you know, nobody's time is completely used up, and they join in and they pitch in for educational materials. And so you can, you know, much better than sending a kid to public school. You have your own private schools. Same thing with food. Now we got grocery stores, but in the old days you had farmers markets. That's what they did. You know, you didn't go to a grocery store. Back in China, still in China, they have farmers markets, probably the most popular way to buy things. And it's where everybody brings their goods, and they set up a table and a tent in a parking lot or in a farm field or along the side of the road. And that's where you go shopping. So setting up your own farmers markets to supply yourself with food, you make your own deals with the farmers, you invite them in, you invite them to sell their produce to you. And that's one way of making sure that you get fed. You don't need the government debit, EBT cards and food stamps if you have people working together. The other thing is a buying group. Let's say, okay, you need to buy groceries. Well, if 10 of you chip in the money you would spend every week to do grocery shopping, and you buy in bulk as a group, well, you're saving anywhere from 30 to 50%. You can even then, you know, form a small limited company and get a wholesaler's license. And then you don't need to go to the grocery store. You go direct to the wholesaler and you buy at a 50% discount. So everybody saves money. And again, it's a small community, 10 people just pitching in their money. You know, I spend $100 a week on groceries. I got another 9 families that spend the same, let's say. So now we got $1,000 a week. Trust me, I can go to any grocery store. I mean, the easy one would be just to get a Costco card and everybody buy that. But I can go to a grocery store and I can bargain. You know, we're going to take, 100 pounds of potatoes. What do you know, what's your price for 100 pounds cash? I can bargain in with $1,000 more than I can bargain with $100. And so, again, a small community will provide for your food. So we can see that, and these in the past were called mutual aid societies, and you know, the Moose Lodge and the Brotherhood of the Knights of Gibraltar, and you know, they had all these funky names and all that, but what it was is small communities looking after their own needs. And there's a numerous ways that this can be done. So in terms of medicine, food, education, those needs are all taken care of, and other needs too, your spiritual needs. You can have support groups for drug addiction. You can bring people together to build shelters for homeless people. You can, set up counseling groups for alcoholics and people that are depressed. You can set up a group of people that will visit seniors buildings and talk to the seniors and bring them a little bit of food, maybe some fresh apples and things like that. So you can take care of everybody. It's very simple. There's only one thing standing in the way of this, Daniel, and that is people are selfish assholes. if you can get over this selfishness, if you can just drop your greed and your you know, your envy and your, you know, everybody's big ego, you know, oh, I'm right, you're wrong, I'm right. You know, this is what separates people. In forming these groups, you vote on things in a true democracy, and you elect people to carry out these functions. So, and then you have just, you know, once you voted on the rules and the regulations and the people you want to handle the major duties of this organization, then shut up and follow along, you know, and contribute to it instead of causing discord. And that's what I found is often, again, from my study of history, a lot of the times that these mutual aid societies, first of all, most of the mutual aid societies were destroyed by the actions of the government. The government does not like you being self-reliant. Oh, no, 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 no. You're hiring your own doctor? No, you must go to the AMA. The AMA then fired any doctor that worked privately for a mutual aid society. So they destroyed the private medical benefits of these companies by attacking the doctors and revoking their licenses to practice and firing them. So in order for the pharmaceutical company and the Rockefellers to institute their own demonic death system called modern medicine, but it was the government that destroyed all these things. It was the government that got rid of people teaching. You know, how many countries in the world is it illegal to homeschool your children? Well, why is it illegal? Government doesn't want you to actually educate your children. Government wants you to send your children to these meat grinders called public education, where they come out with no brains, no intelligence, and they're dyed-in-the-wool communists now. Yeah. So it's the government that has attacked us on all those levels. Now, once you eliminate the attacks of the government, the reason a lot of these groups failed is because of internal squabbling. That's what it is. People just couldn't get along, couldn't work together. Too many disagreements at the meeting. And then they formed into cliques and factions. And then the cliques and factions fought against each other, which is why, for example, in my upcoming book, why I recommend that, yes, we vote. But before any motion can be passed by the community, it must pass by at least an 80% margin. Because if it's just 51 to 49, you're always going to get two groups. You're always going to get two groups. And then they're going to fight against each other. And then they're going to try and get their policies passed. And then, you know, it just breaks down to internecine warfare. And that's what destroys the community. My thinking is that if you want to pass a motion, and it's a really good idea, then everybody should be on board. Yeah, that's a great idea. 80% of people say, yep, I'm really good with that. You know, 10%, 20% might not like it. But if you've got 80% on your side, then, you know, there's really not too much they're going to be able to do to destroy the community. They can maybe leave or whatever, but which is always an option. But it's not going to result in this civil war. And which is what, you know, what they've tried to do all the time, too. So that's the idea with the communities. I mean, it can solve literally all our problems. We take the power back from the government. They're not going to be able to supply these services for much longer anyways. And we put it back in the hands of the community and the people, where the people oversee it, where the people fund it, where the people participate in it. And with that, you can solve every problem our society faces.
Absolutely, absolutely. Creating constructive solutions from the ground up without having to rely on experts or whoever it is from on high dictating to us, you know, what ought to be done and who ought to be listened to. These are time-tested methods of simple humans behaving in the way that I think is probably intrinsic to our nature. I mean, fish organize into schools, wolves into packs. Well, humans organize into this thing we call society or community, whatever word we want to tack onto it. This is what we do. And the sooner we, I think, embrace what is natural for us to do, which is to work together in these small local communities in which we take care of one another, the sooner we can actually get back to having sustainable lives. Because now we've just sort of outsourced our natural inclination to be a community, to this sort of abstract thing called a nation state or whatever, where, you know, we've got it in our heads that we're members of a community of like 350 million people. Well, it just doesn't work that way. The institutions that are built to serve a community that large are simply not going to be able to deliver what they promise, even if they were acting in good faith, which, you know, many of them are probably not. But even if they were, even if they genuinely did want to serve the public, it just seems to me quite a stretch to imagine that it would be even possible for institutions to serve, to consistently serve people in such a large population with any sense of quality. So the sooner we get back to the way humans have been organizing and caring for each other for literally over 100,000 years, then we'll probably be getting back on the right track. This is another one. We talk about the sort of gradual collapse into an authoritarian state or something like that, that happens over time after the society has been demoralized. What if instead of that sort of gradual thing, you find yourself in an immediate, surprise, catastrophic situation for, let's say, like an Oklahoma City bombing or a 9/11 scenario? Like if something just, holy shit, happens right in front of your face, what would you do, or what should one do in a catastrophe like that, that for all intents and purposes could not have been foreseen?
Okay, well, I just had a consultation with a lady yesterday, because I also offer, if you want to talk to me one-on-one, go to my website under consulting, and you can book. I say 90 minutes, but I usually do 2 hours with the people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you need to assess your threat, what kinds of threats that you might have faced. A large part of this is planning. And here we get back into the philosophy. In Stoicism, one of the exercises, or one of the one of the exercises that the Stoics use is called negative imagination. Now that sounds terrible, and you know the whole New Age movement has convinced us that any negative thoughts will give you cancer immediately. But that's not true. What a Stoic does is he goes through all the possible scenarios of what could go wrong, and then if this goes wrong, then how will I deal with it? And then if that goes wrong, then how will I fix that? And it's actually a very good a way to prepare. You need to examine, because you need plans. So let's say you have to evacuate. Well, for example, something sudden happens. For example, the woman I was speaking to yesterday, she lives on an island off the coast of Washington State. Now, we have recently had lots of earthquakes in the Pacific, you know, Indonesia, and now the other day was Japan, and we're seeing the volcanoes, and now we're having tsunami alerts. So, you know, her immediate threat would be a tsunami or a massive earthquake. So we went over, well, what would you do then? Well, the best thing to do is to get to high ground. Now, there was a small mountain about 2,000 feet above sea level, 5 minutes from where she lives. I said, well, there you go. So in the case of a tsunami alert, and the other thing you have to do is set up, you go to one of the National Weather and Aeronautics Society websites and set up an alert that you'll get an email if there's a tsunami warning for your area. So, you know, again, you have to plan this all out in advance. This is the type of threat. Well, okay, this is how we prepare for it. So she also now has put together a good bug out bag, and she keeps it close to the garage door next to her truck or SUV. So now here's your plan. If you get a tsunami alert and you have to evacuate, and you may have a 4-hour notice, you may have 20 minute notice, then bug out bag goes into the truck, the cat goes into the truck, off you go, 5 minutes up the road, you go up the mountain, and there you make camp. You've got your food, you've got your tent, you got your shelter, you can build a fire, you got your emergency radios with you so you can communicate with people, you can get information. That is how you deal with that. So you have to think about what the potential threats are to your life and in the area that you live in. So the other, you know, if you live in Northern California, the potential threat is a forest fire. You know, they were devastated last year and the year before with these forest fires, all started on purpose. So, well, what is the solution to that? Well, first of all, you got to, again, have an evacuation plan. Where are you going to go? Where can you go during a forest fire? Look what happened there in Australia. They had a huge forest fire and all these people were trapped on the beach, you know, and they had to send boats to evacuate them from the beach because they couldn't go anywhere else. All they did is they headed for the nearest source of water. So you need to make a plan. If this happens, I do what? If the house is on fire, where do I go? If, you know, a train derails and there's chlorine gas cloud coming into town, you know, barreling our way, where's the best way to, what's the best way to get out of town? What's the best place to run to? Make sure you got your stuff with you, you know, your 3-day bug out bag. Or let's say you're, you know, there's roving gangs of looters. Maybe it's not a good idea to be on the road at that time. So now, if there's roving gangs of looters, what's the best way to fortify your house? What are the weapons do you need to have handy by the front door? What do you do about the windows? How do you, you know, I recommend, of course, that you, you know, board up your windows and turn off the lights and be quiet and spray paint graffiti all over your front door so that the looters will think your house has already been looted. And we'll move on. So again, we're using disguise, we're using deception to avoid being looted. So the most important thing you can do is make plans. And I've got that in the book. You know, you need a rendezvous location. Where do we all meet up? Now, let's say you have kids, they're at school, your wife's at the office, you're at the office, you're all separated. And now a warning comes down that says everybody has to evacuate. Who's going to go get the children? Is the school going to release them or is the school going to keep them there and shelter in place? How are you going to contact your wife? Who's going to go there? Where are you all going to meet up afterwards, right? Because, oh, we're all going to run out of the city, but your wife might be coming from one direction, the kids from another, and you from a third. Where are you going to meet? So you need to establish ahead of time. Here's the rendezvous location. We're all going to meet at Jack's Apple House on Highway 15 outside of town. And then you need a retreat location. So let's say the disaster is even bigger than that. And Jack's Apple House on the outskirts of town is in danger too. Well, then we'll all meet at the Triple K campground 50 miles away. You need to plan all these things out ahead of time. If you make these plans, and then you gather the little bit of supplies and equipment needed to make these plans work, then you're good. You're safe. So nothing can catch you by surprise. You're not like, you know, watching TV and suddenly the alarm comes out. Everybody get out now. And you don't know what to do. You're running around the house. Where's my shoes? You know, where's my raincoat? Anybody seen the flashlight? Who's got batteries? I mean, forget about it. That has to be ready and ahead of time. And you know instantly, uh-oh. Guys, let's go to the rendezvous location first, see how it goes. If things get worse, we go to the retreat location. That's your plan. So you got to plan this thing out all ahead of time.
Excellent. Excellent. Makes a lot of sense. So I want to be respectful of your time. I don't want to take up too much longer, and I do want to open up the floor to questions. But I do just have one more thing that I'd like to ask you before turning it over to the masses, our small audience here. But before I ask my last question, how can people find your work and what are you working on now that people can look forward to?
Okay, so you can find my work on YouTube, all my YouTube videos. I've got over 200 and it's YouTube/Stefan Verstappen, and it's just my name. I didn't come up with a nice fancy marketing term. I should have, but just Google my name in YouTube and you'll find all my videos there. My website is www.chinastrategies.com. And it has nothing to do with China other than my first book that came out 22 years ago was called Chinese Strategies. And so when I got my first URL, I went for China Strategies to match the book. I should have changed it to something else by now, but I never got around to it. So everything is on that website. My art, my books, my videos, my articles, my essays, it's all on that website. And it's jam-packed with stuff, but now you have to kind of scoot around. What I'm working on now. Well, I'm doing my taxes.
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah. Well, I got it because I got to apply for this, this COVID relief funds, and you can't do that without filing your tax return. But I'm working on a couple of videos coming out. One is my worst nightmare come true, in which I talk about the communist dictatorship that we are living under and the how the mass psychosis has aided and abetted the communist takeover. Also, my book that I'm still working on is The Complete Guide to Forming Communities for Mutual Aid, Self-Reliance, and Charity, in which I'm going to list, you know, like 30, 40, 50 different communities you can form. And anything from just a small community where you just volunteer to spend an hour of your time once a week to more larger communities. For example, a survivalist community where, you know, 10, 20 families work together to make sure that no matter what happens, they'll have the food, they'll have the protection, they'll have the medical care that they need to service a larger community. So that's the other thing I'm working on. Yeah, I'm working on a lot of stuff. And but that's it for now. ChinaStrategies.com and Stefan Verstappen at YouTube to watch all my fascinating videos.
Well, excellent. I'll put all that stuff in the show notes. I'm looking forward to delving more into your work. I know you've got the ultimate library set of like 280 plus books. So that's I've got a lot of homework to do, and I'm really excited to get into it. And I'm really looking forward to that that upcoming book of yours, because, I mean, like I said, I've been talking to my wife about exactly that topic for like a year, and it's been like, oh, how come no one's thinking about this?
So, I know, I thought the same thing. How come nobody else is doing this? You know, a part of the problem too is with forming these communities, there's a bit of paperwork involved. And what I'm trying to do with the book is do all the paperwork for you. So a community needs a charter. You know, you have to clearly state what your goals and objectives are, what the rules of the community are, so that everybody's on the same page. One of the reasons these communities fell apart in the past is like everybody gets together and says, okay, we're all going to work together. And then one guy does all the work, and then other people standing around complaining. You know, this is often what happens in communes and things like that. That's why all these communes all died. You know, the founding members did all the work. By the time they got 200 members, they weren't doing anything. They weren't contributing. So these are your obligations. This is what is required of you to be a member of this community. And the other thing, too, is you got to filter out the bad apples. You don't want everybody in your community. You want people that have skills and talents and that can contribute. So I've included things like questionnaires, like what do you bring to the community? You know, are you a paramedic? Are you a gardener? Do you know how to grow a hydroponic garden or plant raised bed gardens? Can you fix machines? Can you improvise wind turbines or water turbines for electrical power? I mean, everybody's got to bring something. I mean, if you have no skills and you have no money and you have no intelligence, well, you know, does everybody have to carry you? No, you're not welcome. You're not invited. So you need things like a charter and like an induction form, you know, that people can fill out. And including things like when you join the group, do you have any medical conditions, you know, that the group needs to know about? We don't want you keeling over in a heart attack in the garden, and that nobody knew that you were susceptible to that, and it comes as a big shock. You know, put down your medical conditions so that we can prepare for it. Maybe we have to buy an automatic electronic defibrillator and keep it in the clubhouse for everybody that has a heart condition. You know, so, you know, we cover everybody's bases that way, but you got to think all of this out. There's a lot of small detail, and I'm trying to do that in this book. I'm thinking out all the little details. And then also, you know, do you want to incorporate or a non-incorporation or a charitable organization? Do you want to be able to offer tax deductions for donations? And there's benefits and drawbacks to each one of these formations, each one of these legal formations, because, you know, there are, again, you need to think about this ahead of time. Maybe it's worth it to become a nonprofit. That way you can solicit donations. You know, you call yourself the Wisconsin Audubon Society. And I recommend anybody that forms a community to choose as dull and non-inflammatory a name as possible. Now, I know there's a group out there called Freedom Cells. And the first problem is the name Freedom Cells. That's going to raise an alarm on every algorithm on the internet, right?
Yeah.
Remember, we're living in a time of tyranny. You're not allowed to say freedom without attracting attention. And cells implies a communist counter-revolutionary organization. So if you go around calling yourself a freedom cell, then welcome to Waco. Welcome to Ruby Ridge.
Right.
So I recommend people, you know, the world, the Wisconsin Wildlife Preservation Society. Now, if you want to stockpile guns and ammunition and food and build a bunker out in the country, go for it. Yeah, you can do that. Just don't call it a militia.
Right. So you're saying I shouldn't call my group the Armed Illuminati?
No. No, Daniel.
Okay. Noted.
Not Daniel's Gang of Assassins. No, that wouldn't work. But listen, this goes way back. You know, the modern Chinese triads, they all started off as anti-government groups. Mm-hmm. Going way back, you know, there was the Yellow Turbans and then the Red Turbans and the White Lotus Society and then the Triad Societies, the Heaven, Earth, and Man Society, and the Hongs and the Tongs. And all of these people were originally started off as community aid groups, mutual aid groups that were against the government. So they were secret organizations. They helped their members to avoid persecution by the government. And they did exactly what we were talking about: safe houses, underground railroad, food, medicine, shelter. They provided all those. And, you know, there's a famous Chinese book called All Men Are Brothers, or The Water Margin is another title for it. And tells the story of, you know, these revolutionary groups trying to overthrow the evil emperor, just like Star Wars, you know. So these groups have been around for a long time, and they've all followed a similar pattern. You know, they call themselves the White Lotus. They didn't call themselves the Let's Kill the Emperor Society, you know, but that's what they were. That's what they were. You know, White Lotus sort of sounds, you know, well, it's a flower. So we have to apply those same tactics and strategies.
Absolutely. Well, look, this is a tremendous conversation. Probably 20 more questions. But the last thing that I'll ask before opening it up to the couple people we've got here with us is simply a practical, basic question. What is one habit or skill that anybody listening to this interview right now, when they're done with it, can go right outside or whatever, wherever they need to go, and make sure that they can actually perform this simple, basic task? What is something that we should all just know how to do, that we can all make sure we know how to do it right now?
The most important skill you're going to need is the ability to walk long distances. Take walks in the woods, like you mentioned earlier. It's one of the best things in the world. Go for a walk in the woods along a wooded path. Because during these times when, you know, everything is collapsing, you might not be able to get gas for your car. So you're going to be walking everywhere. So you need good shoes and you need to get, you know, you have to build up to a hike. So start off with walks and then build up to a hike up hills and down on downhills until you're in good shape so that you can walk 10 miles a day without problem. That would be a good start. So simply going out for a walk, that's one of the best things you can do right now.
That is tremendous advice. That's your homework, everyone listening. Go for a goddamn walk. And we've got two questions coming in from the chat. The first one is from Kevin, and he asks, what kind of timeline does Stefan have for the collapse he feels is coming?
Yeah, the timeline is always very tricky because we don't know, you know, what's going on behind the scenes. They've speeded up their timeline. Something's happened. This whole COVID thing is... you know, it's a little bit too brazen. Usually they're a little bit slower working at it, but now they've, for some reason, they're wanting to speed up our destruction. So it's very difficult to say what the timeline is, but, you know, out of the horse's mouth, they're saying 2025. So there's your timeline. You know, that's what the New World Order, the Great Reset, climate, COVID, climate change analysts, you know, the zero carbon goals and all that nonsense, they're all kind of pointing to 2025. So I think that's pretty much after that, there's not going to be too many people left.
Okay, so we got to start getting ready now.
Oh, yeah.
The next question is from Ron, and he asks, when faced with a number of Marxists trying to shame you in public, what is your best tactic to disengage and evade? You certainly cannot do combat with a mob without deadly force.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no, listen, first of all, never feel shame and never apologize, because you're giving in, you're surrendering when you apologize. And also, like I said, Marxists, they're insane. They're part of the mass psychosis. They do not have the ability to engage in conversation with you. They're nuts. So there's nothing you can do but gently back away. I tell people, it's like you're walking in the woods and suddenly you come across a grizzly bear. What do you do? Well, slowly back away until you're far enough away from them where you can turn around and run into the bush. That's it, because they're insane. They're out of control. They'll go after you if you start running right away. So just placate them. Oh, yeah, that's a good point. I never thought about that. Wait a minute. Oh, dear, I'm sorry. I got to go right now. I have an appointment, you know, because you can't deal with them, you know, just schmooze them, just bullshit them, you know, tell them whatever they want to hear to get them to leave you alone, because you're not dealing with normal people. You're dealing with insane people. So don't engage. Absolutely. Try to avoid any engagement ahead of time. But if you are suddenly, you know, confronted with these people, tell them whatever they want to hear. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Black Lives Matter. Yeah, I agree. Oh, my God, it's so terrible. Hey, I got to go now. So just get away, you know, whatever it takes.
Right, right. And yeah, it's not like you need to die on the ideological hill whenever you encounter some agent of whatever authoritarianism you're living under. You know, you live, yeah, in Nazi Germany, you don't need to walk up to, on principle, you don't need to walk up to the Gestapo dude hanging out on the street corner and say, hey, you know, Hitler's a dick. You know, like, yeah, sure, he is. Yeah. But maybe you don't need to poke the bear. Maybe there's a more tactful way to actually undermine that authoritarianism than just, you know, being a flagrant fool, essentially,
yeah,
by putting yourself on the line like that.
Well, Sun Tzu says, never fight a battle you don't know you can win. And, you know, we're not psychiatrists. We cannot win the battle with crazy people. You know, we don't have 20 years to put them into counseling. So there's no winning that battle. So why even bother? You just evade and escape until there is a battle that you can win. Now, if it's somebody that, you know, they're, you know, purple pilled, they're a little bit awake and they really need a little bit of help coming to our side. Okay. Engage them, you know, offer them some information and some encouragement, bring them over. There's not too many people like that left. Everybody's pretty much chosen a side by now. Most of them chosen the side of evil, but, but otherwise, no, don't engage. You can't win that battle. You can't fight crazy, and you can't fix stupid.
Right, right. Well, again, the best thing, this, it all goes back to the community thing. The best thing that you can do is just actually be constructive, to be productive, to get the people who are going to actually help you move forward in life, to create actual solutions to real issues. Let's just start taking care of each other. And while other people might want to bicker about the ideological implications of some abstract political bloviation that they saw on television, well, I'm growing tomatoes. You're growing beans. You know, like, you can have your little arguments and you can all theorize together in your ivory tower. But when it comes down to it, who are the people who are actually engaging with the planet in order to procure the material resources that we all need to not die? You know, that's the thing to do, really, when it comes down to it, is don't even concern yourself so much with the mob, because if you're doing that, then you're probably wasting your time. Because if you're out confronting so-and-so on the street, if you're being Alex Jones 20 years ago with the blowhorn or whatever, the bullhorn, yeah, then that means that you're not being productive somewhere else. Instead, you're putting on a show, and, well, shows belong on TV. That's all it is. It's theater. It'd be a much better use of time to be teaching your children valuable lessons about how to engage with the world and how to engage with other people in a way that's not inflammatory, but is also dignified, growing your own food, cleaning your house, et cetera, et cetera. These are the things that we can actually do if you really want to combat the mob. It's like, what's the old saying? Like, the best revenge is a successful life or something like that.
Yeah,
like, if you really want to beat them, then cultivate yourself, cultivate your surroundings, and succeed. That's the best thing to do.
Yeah. Best revenge is living well.
There you go. Right.
Yeah, no. And I agree with that. And I actually follow that principle myself. Mm-hmm. I'm always giving back. I take people out on canoe trips, you know, teach them how to paddle a canoe and take them out into the wilderness and teach them a little bit about nature and get them some fresh air and exercise. I'll organize picnics on the beach and bonfires and cookouts and barbecues and hikes. And I teach Tai Chi in the park for free. And I also, I'm also an artist, and everywhere I've lived, there is an art piece somewhere in that city made by me. I'll create something beautiful and pretty, and I'll put it in like a public park, like maybe you get a little birdhouse and you paint it up really nice with some gold trim on it, and you just hang it up in the tree there in the park, you know, high enough so that the kids can't get at it, but bring a little bit of beauty to the world around you, and in whatever form of beauty that is. Maybe you want to, you know, I often cook and bring meals around to the neighbors. Come on over. I got, you know, Papa Stefano's pasta salad supremo, which is my own personal recipe. It's pasta salad. Each spoonful is 2,000 calories. it's just packed full of goodness. And, the other thing is I take out my guitar. I can play guitar and harmonica at the same time and sing some songs around the campfire, invite people to bring their instruments over. If you got a violin or an auto harp or a dulcimer, you know, preferably acoustic instruments, because you can play that outdoors without electricity. Let's get together and sing some songs, you know, learn some real songs, some old folk songs. How many people can name a song that is part of their cultural heritage, let alone sing it? You know,
right.
But music used to be a huge part of community. Everybody would get together and they would sing, you know, the songs that their grandparents sang and their great grandparents sang that represented their culture, represented their tribe. And it's a very enriching experience when people get together and share music. It's bonding, it's uplifting, it's healing, and it brings people together. So find ways to, even though we're living under all this pressure and stress and paranoia, you know, like, don't let it get you down. Go out, play a song, go out and, you know, teach the neighborhood kids how to go fishing, how to hook a worm on a hook and fish, or, you know, take your friends out for a canoe trip. You know, let's paddle around the lake for a couple hours and have a picnic on the island. You know, these are positive actions that bring people together. And the other thing about community that I haven't touched upon is that you will be healthier. I work with a doctor, Dr. Ronald Kapp. He's recently come up with a book on longevity, how to live to be, you know, 100 years old without any, you know, illness or disease, no arthritis, no Alzheimer's, no high blood pressure, no heart disease. One of the biggest keys to staying healthy, and what they've studied from groups and communities all over the world where people live to be 100 years old, you know, what was the secret? How come everybody in this village lives to be 110? The secret is they belong to a community. They get together all the time. They have lunch every day with people, with friends they've known for 60 years. They have a little bit of wine. They have some bread and salad, and they talk and they gossip and they chit chat. Community will keep you healthier. And it's no surprise that they have been separating us with the social distancing and wearing the goddamn masks, because both of those things are designed to make you sicker. It's designed to reduce your body's immunity. So in addition to helping all your material needs, helping your spiritual needs, it also will help your immunity system. It will help you to fight off disease and illness, and it will even make you live longer.
In 1814, we took a little trip along with Colonel Jackson down the mighty Mississippi. We took a little bacon and we took a little beans, and we caught the bloody British in a town in New Orleans. We fired our guns and the British kept a-coming. There wasn't as many as there was a while ago. We fired once more and they began to run it on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. We looked down a river and we see the British come, and there must have been 100 of them beating on the drum. They stepped so high and they made the bugles ring. We stood beside our cotton fields and didn't say a thing. We fired our guns and the British kept a-coming. There wasn't as many as there was a while ago. We fired once more and they began to run it on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. Old Hickory said we could take them by surprise if we didn't fire muskets till we looked them in the eye. We held our fire till we see their faces well. Then we opened up our squirrel guns and really gave them well. We fired our guns and the British kept a-coming. There wasn't as many as there was a while ago. We fired once more and they began to run it on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. Yeah, they ran through the briars and they ran through the brambles and they ran through the bushes where a rabbit couldn't go. They ran so fast that the hounds couldn't catch them on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. We fired our cannon till the barrel melted down, so we grabbed an alligator and we fought another round. We filled his head with cannonballs and powdered his behind, and when we touched the powder off, the gator lost his mind. We fired our guns and the British kept a-coming. There wasn't as many as there was a while ago. We fired once more and they began to run it on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. Yeah, they ran through the briars and they ran through the brambles and they ran through the bushes where a rabbit couldn't go. They ran so fast that the hounds couldn't catch them on down the Mississippi to